is Friday, November 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, gunmen attack a luxury hotel in Bamako, Mali, and at least three people are dead. We talked to a reporter on the scene.
The road leading up to the hotel, we'd say that the Malian SWAT team are here and several police cars.
Security is tight at the ASEAN summit in Malaysia, and we hear about country singer Chris Young's new hit album. It's all ahead. Gunmen have attacked a hotel in the capital of Mali in Bamako, and I'm joined on the line by reporter Katerina Hoogja. Katerina, what exactly is going on there at the moment?
Well, I'm outside a hotel standing by a military blockade. They obviously closed off all the routes, the roads leading up to the hotel. We'd say that the Malian SWAT team are here and several police cars. We've been hearing occasional explosions, but the gunfire has stopped since a couple of hours ago. And about a while ago, there were a couple of people who managed to exit the hotel, about 20 people, apparently the hostages, that managed to either escape or were actually liberated by the Malian forces.
Has anyone taken responsibility for this?
Not as far as I know. There have been an increased amount of attacks, of terrorist attacks in central and southern Mali. You had a hostage situation in Sevar at the hotel where you have a lot of UN peacekeeper and contractors staying about a couple of months ago. And that was claimed by Al-Qaeda groups. So far, we haven't heard anything about this attack.
And this attack happened at a hotel, the Radisson Blue Hotel. Usually, who stays at that hotel?
Well, it is a place for Westerners. You have UN staff staying there. We know that there are a lot of foreigners staying there. Apparently, there are some Americans staying at the hotel at the moment. I haven't been able to get that confirmed, but that's what I understand.
Is there an increased security presence? I mean, are more security officials coming to the area around the hotel?
There are several security officials surrounding the area, both the Malian Army, police, and the Gendarmerie. And a couple of moments ago, a few UN cars also pulled up at the hotel, which would indicate that there are UN staff staying there.
What about, you might not know this, but would there be any possibility that French troops might assist?
I haven't heard anything. I'm sure that the French embassy is monitoring the situation. So far, I haven't seen any French troops on the ground. As we know, they're mostly conducting anti-terrorism operations in the north of the country, and not that many are stationed in the capital.
I see here that the French news agency, AFP, is reporting that two women were released, and Reuters is saying that the gunmen released hostages who were able to recite verses from the Quran.
That is also what we've been hearing on the ground, but haven't been able to confirm anything. Unfortunately, we're too far away to be able to speak to any hostages, and now there was just gunfire coming from the hotel. So at the moment, I don't think it can get any closer.
Okay, thanks very much. That is Katerina Hoogja reporting from Bamako, Mali. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, officials in Mali say gunmen who shouted Islamic phrases while overtaking the luxury hotel have killed at least three of their 170 hostages. Mali has urged its residents to stay where they are and not venture out during the hotel siege. Turkish Airlines says six of its personnel are trapped in the hotel. French, Nigerian, and Chinese nationals are also among those being held hostage. Authorities say the gunmen rode up to the hotel in a vehicle with diplomatic license plates. The U.S. Embassy in Mali said in a statement Friday the embassy is aware of an ongoing active shooter operation at the Radisson Hotel. The embassy urged all U.S. citizens and the embassy staff to shelter in place. Well, for reaction on social media, I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akisholu.
Hi, Sarah. Well, news about the Mali attack has been breaking pretty fast on Twitter. Xinhua News, the official Chinese state press agency, tweeted out a video that it says is from a Chinese tourist taken hostage in Bamako. In the video, the tourist is filming from inside the window of a building several stories up. It's under 30 seconds, but it's not very clear. You only see two people outside, and you don't know if they're gunmen or not. Xinhua tweeted out the video a little before 7:30 UTC, which is around when the story first started breaking. A few other news outlets so far have picked it up, Sky News and RT. The U.S. Embassy in Mali, they also tweeted out warnings to American citizens in Mali, telling them to shelter in place, contact their families if possible, and try to adhere to instructions of local authorities and keep up with local media reports.
What are some of the reactions we're seeing on social media?
A lot of people seem shocked that we're hearing about another large terrorist incident just a week after the attacks in Paris. Some are tweeting out prayers for Mali. A few people are also using hashtag Paris attacks in their tweets about the Mali hotel. I started following this story on social media as it was breaking this morning, and one of the earliest geographic locations that Mali started trending worldwide was in fact Paris. That was before it started trending worldwide and here in the U.S. And that probably has something to do with the time difference and people being awake to read the news and post on social media about it. But also, people still grieving from last week's violent attacks can certainly empathize with what's going on in Bamako right now. But also in the wake of Paris attacks, a lot of people were angry at how much stronger the reaction was to those in Paris than other recent terrorism incidents in other countries. Well, social media users are certainly very concerned by what's going on in Mali right now.
Thanks very much, Olin. That's Olin Akisholo. U.S. President Barack Obama is in Malaysia for the ASEAN Summit, a gathering of regional leaders expected to focus on economic issues, terrorism, and territorial disputes. I'm joined on the line by VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman, who's in Kuala Lumpur. Well, Steve, what kind of security is in force at this summit?
Well, Sarah, as you know, at these summits with many leaders coming, security is always pretty tight. And then a few days ago, Malaysia said that it had doubled the security, and now again, they say they have further increased it. Some 2,000 soldiers stationed here in Kuala Lumpur, another 2,500 were told on standby. And this all because of an unconfirmed terrorist threat that went out in a police bulletin a few days ago from Sabah here in Malaysia.
How much will this summit be focused on terrorism, particularly in light of the recent attacks in Paris?
Well, it's certainly going to be discussed. It was not intended a few weeks ago to be one of the big issues, but that has changed, obviously, because of the attacks in Paris and also because of rising concerns about extremists that are in the southern Philippines and recently kidnapped and claimed to have beheaded a Malaysian that they kidnapped from Sabah. And now police on Sabah saying they have information that elements sympathetic to the so-called Islamic State, the Abu Sayyaf group and the Moro National Liberation Front, apparently had a meeting last Sunday in the southern Philippines autonomous province of Sulu to presumably plot to dispatch suicide bombers all the way here to KL to try to disrupt the ASEAN summit.
Apparently, President Obama, he held a town hall where he called on young Southeast Asian leaders to reject extremism and to embrace tolerance.
Right, and that's the message we're also hearing for the Malaysian leaders. And they've been claiming for a long time that they've had things under control. But if you talk to the analysts, they say that for some decades now, Malaysia has been seeing a rise in the militant jihadi movement. The defense minister here earlier in the week noted just increased concerns about not just in Malaysia, but in the region as a whole. And that's being echoed today by the prime minister, Najib Razak, who says he'll talk more about it tomorrow during the ASEAN conference. And I also spoke briefly today to the foreign minister, who also said that this will be a subject of discussion by the ministers on Saturday.
Senior White House officials are saying that President Obama will use the ASEAN summit to raise the issue of China's territorial disputes with its neighbors. Certainly in recent months, that has been a large issue of concern in Southeast Asia.
Certainly, and the Chinese have been pushing back in recent days, knowing that this was going to be on the agenda here at the ASEAN and East Asia summits in the coming days. And the message that we've been hearing from the Chinese is saying, you know, to paraphrase them, that well, if you think we've been aggressive, we think we've actually been very restrained and have not grabbed other territory that we think is legitimately ours in the South China Sea. So I think what we're going to see is as much push as there is from the Philippines, in particular Vietnam and the United States, that we're going to see some pushback from China as well.
Thanks very much, Steve. That is VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman reporting from Kuala Lumpur. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Want to be as anonymous online as possible? One thing British researchers suggest you do is to be very careful selecting your username. Psychologists from the UK's University of York have found that the usernames of those who play online video games can reveal a lot about the actual personalities and even the ages of the individuals themselves. They found players whose username included some kind of profanity or other crude words or phrases were also more inclined to be more antisocial in their gameplay interactions with their online opponents than those with rather benign usernames. On the other hand, they also found that gamers with more positive usernames tended to have positive in-game behavior. The researchers say the data from online video games could provide valuable insight into the players' personalities and possible disorders such as autism or addictive personality. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Chris Young's new hit album, I'm Coming Over. Cambodia's opposition leader, Sam Rainsy, is accusing the ruling party of carrying out a constitutional coup after a local court issued an arrest warrant for him and a parliamentary committee stripped him of his seat. In a message published on Facebook, the politician says the ruling party is taking measures to try to eliminate the country's main opposition party. Robert Carmichael reports from Phnom Penh.
Opposition leader Sam Rainsy was originally scheduled to return to Cambodia late Monday after visits to Japan and South Korea. But he postponed his arrival after a court issued an arrest warrant for him on Friday, and a parliamentary committee controlled by the ruling party subsequently stripped him of his legal immunity and his seat. Rainsy has yet to fix a return date. On Wednesday, the Cambodia Daily newspaper reported that negotiations were underway to organise a deal between the opposition leader and strongman Prime Minister Hun Sen, who has ruled the country for three decades. The standoff caps weeks of rising tensions between the ruling party and the opposition. Late last month, the ruling Cambodian People's Party's legislators voted to fire the opposition's deputy head, Kem Sokar, from his parliamentary post. Days earlier, a mob severely beat two opposition lawmakers as they left parliament, as police and security guards stood by. Later that day, a mob attacked Kem Sokar's private residence. The police ignored pleas for help from his wife, who was trapped inside their home. Many people believe the ruling CPP ordered the attacks, though a party spokesman denied that was the case. Political analyst U Virak, the founder of the think tank The Future Forum, says the current discord has strong echoes with the ruling party's actions before the 2008 and 2013 general elections.
It has worked magic in the past, so Hun Sen is looking at this as a page from an old playbook, and he's definitely in some way is going back to the same tactic that has worked for him so cheaply, so easily, by just bringing legal charge with a court that he has full control over.
The opposition Cambodia National Rescue Party, or CNRP, stunned the ruling party when it came close to winning the 2013 general election, losing by just 300,000 votes, or around 4% of the electorate. Virak says the ruling party realizes that its 2013 pledge to enact reforms is proving hard to carry out, which is why it is now trying to divide the opposition ahead of the 2018 ballot.
After the 2013 election, which was a very, very close election, the CPP thought they can actually look at reforms and try to attract young voters. I think they realize it's actually much more difficult, particularly with an entrenched corrupt system that they've built, that they have. So they are now they're basically resorting to old tactics, old dirty tactics, and which is using the courts, which they have full control to bring about legal harassment of Mr. Samrinsi that has worked magic in the past and still work today.
Overnight, the spokesman for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described the arrest warrant against Ranzi and the earlier attacks on opposition MPs as, quote, worrisome developments, end quote, and urged both parties to resume talks. It has been a difficult year for the opposition. 15 activists were jailed earlier this year after being convicted of insurrection, and a senator is currently awaiting trial on the charge of forging a public document. The cases against them are widely regarded as politically motivated. The arrest warrant against Ranzi relates to a 2011 court decision in which he was found guilty in absentia of defamation and ordered to serve 2 years in jail after stating that Foreign Minister Hornam Hong helped to run a Khmer Rouge prison during Pol Pot's brutal 1970s rule. However, that conviction was widely believed to have been quashed ahead of the 2013 election when Ranzi was issued a royal pardon, allowing him to return from exile to contest the vote. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Country singer Chris Young has just released his new CD, I'm Coming Over. The title track has reached number one on the Billboard Country Airplay chart. International Edition's David Byrd tells us Young has made a career out of love songs and romantic ballads, but can still sing rock and honky-tonk anthems, too.
I'm coming over.
Chris Young first came to the public eye as the winner of 2006's Nashville Star Talent Competition. His song Voices from his first EP entered the Billboard Top 40 at number 37. His first number one hit, Getting You Home, came from his second album, The Man I Want to Be. In all, the album produced three number one hits for Young. The singer would get two more number ones from his next album, Neon. Many of Chris Young's most successful songs deal with love, either finding it, saving it, or losing it. Chris says that he's not ashamed to admit that romance makes up a big part of his repertoire.
You know, I do have a range of songs and stuff that we sing about. There are some party songs and, you know, there's some sad songs, but even a lot of the sad songs are really just, you know, breakup songs. Like a lot of the themes that I deal with as a writer and as an artist really do kind of revolve around or come back to love at some point.
But who I am with you is who I really want to be. You're so good for me. And when I'm holding you, it feels like I've got the world in my hands. Yeah, a better man is who I am with you.
Young, who says he used to ride around in his truck as a teenager, listening not only to country, but also to the crooning of Boys to Men, says that recording love songs has brought him both male and female fans.
I think really for me, you know, I do sing a lot of love songs. I think guys and girls, everybody can relate to love songs. I think that that's, you know, one of the reasons why I've cut so many. But then, you know, if I need to kind of bridge that gap a little bit, you can sing love songs about tequila.
Oh, no, somebody just bought a shot of that Patron. Hang on, I just might have to stay.
Chris Young now has his sixth number one single, the title track from his new CD, I'm Coming Over. The singer says that he believes that he is drawing from a long history in country music.
You know, falling in love with somebody or you know, really just seeing somebody for the first time and having that passionate connection with them, that's something that everybody can relate to regardless of, you know, whether it's, you know, first love or if it's, you know, they've been married for 40, 50 years with somebody.
Chris Young plans to tour in support of the new album beginning in January. Cassidy Pope, who sings a duet with Chris on the new CD, will also be on the tour. Pope was the first female vocalist to win the Voice singing competition in 2012. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
The music of Chris Young. And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Tunisia, where the Arab Spring was born, democratic progress continues. On a recent visit there, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "The eyes of the world are on Tunisia, and America wants Tunisia to succeed." Despite great hardships and two major terrorist attacks, Tunisia has turned time and again to peaceful dialogue, consensus building, and compromise. As a result, Tunisia has built a powerful front against the Islamic extremists who oppose freedom, democracy, and everything that the Tunisian people are striving to build. The United States is committed to helping Tunisia move forward on its economic, democratic, and security objectives. The United States has already provided more than $700 million in foreign assistance to Tunisia since 2011 in the form of direct aid to democracy building, assistance for elections and civil society organizations, and security support. That's why the United States supports Tunisia's ambitious economic reform agenda. The government has proposed specific reforms, which they have forwarded now to the parliament. In an effort to help Tunisia achieve its goals, the U.S. has signed a declaration of intent signifying its readiness to grant a third loan guarantee to Tunisia. In order to protect Tunisia's emerging democracy and growing prosperity, it is essential to enhance security cooperation. Toward that end, President Barack Obama recently announced his intent to designate Tunisia a major non-NATO ally. The U.S. will continue to stand with Tunisia in addressing all terrorist threats. Indeed, the United States welcomes Tunisia's decision to join the global counter-ISIL coalition in September. The terrorists associated with ISIL need to know this. Their days are numbered, and they will be defeated. There is no future, no path forward for ISIL, which does not lead ultimately to its destruction. The United States is committed to standing with the Tunisian people, to deepening the growing partnership that both nations share, and to continuing to support Tunisia's democratic journey.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.